Okay, Michael, as you recall, I went to the Burberry show in London back in February, and I have a thing for the brand's new chief creative officer, Daniel Lee. I wanted everything, especially the bags.
Which one did you have your eye on?
Well, I love what Lee's done with the house's logo. He's a real innovator, and he used the lowercase b as a high-tech but easy-to-fasten clasp on some of the bags. It's especially great in the rocking horse style, which is my current favorite.
Well, there is a certain holiday coming up. Is this the kind of gift that would guarantee your happiness on Mother's Day, perhaps?
Absolutely. It's inspired by Burberry's equestrian heritage, and its playful name is reflected in its shape, which resembles the rocking horses that my children used to love. When it's placed on its base, it rocks back and forth.
Now, this has given me some ideas for my mother as well. There are many other great options too, like her favorite scarves, wallets, and card cases that feature the house's signature Burberry check.
There are great gifts for all different types of stylish mothers and maternal figures at Burberry.com. Happy Saturday. It's April 20th, 2024, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in London.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
Well, it's been a thrilling and mind-boggling week in the news. In New York, Donald Trump's hush money trial is well underway. It's sure to be one of our fixations over the next few weeks. The same can't be said, strangely, for the former president who fell asleep during the first day of jury selection. That being said, with potential witnesses including Stormy Daniels, former Playboy model Karen McDougal, David Pecker of the National Enquirer, and famous presidential fixer Michael Cohen, this trial is shaping up to be far more exciting than any episode of The Apprentice. Meanwhile, in the UK, everyone finally agreed on one thing. Samba sneakers are pretty, pretty cool. And then, all of a sudden, the trend was over when Rishi Sunak wore them over the weekend. Too bad. Anyway, so we're back to chaos over here. But Michael, in airmail, we are the antidote to all of that, and we have much to discuss here on Morning Meeting.
Absolutely. We have a great show today, packed with terrific guests. First, Spike Carter has the wild tale of a man who went from being the boyfriend of Liberace to the pivotal witness in a mass murder to running drugs for the mob. He will explain it all. Then, speaking of explaining, Linda Wells is here to examine a trend that drives me bonkers, Ashley. Men with graying hair who dye their hair. And Linda's going to name names and also tell us about the good, the bad, and the downright fugly ways men should or should not adjust the tint of their hair. We also have novelist Lee Carpenter here, who will tell us about a new book by the legendary editor Michael Korda and how it is a cautionary tale for our times. And finally, here at Airmail, Ashley, you know we have some great news. We have opened a newsstand in New York City. Yes, a brick-and-mortar newsstand in Greenwich Village, and our own Anjali Lewis has the scoop on all the treasures you can find there and how you can now enjoy Airmail and the Airmail universe in person. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Okay, Michael, well, look, I'm sorry to say it. Donald Trump is the preeminent figure in the news cycle this week. So I think we've got to bring Linda Wells on here to talk about a lesser discussed element of the president's legacy, which is his horrifying hair color. Not specifically his, but what happens when men start to go gray and don't know what to do. Linda's the editor of Airmail Look. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you so much, Ashley and Michael. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Linda, you have a fascinating column this week all about what happens when men start going gray. Now, we have a silver fox here among us with Michael Haney, so I look forward to his points of view on this. But, Linda, men and hair dye, a complicated relationship, but one that's getting stronger all the time. Tell us what's going on.
Well, that is absolutely true. Men, God love them. They want to be younger. Who doesn't? But they think that they can do it all by themselves. And so they see the gray coming in and they go right to CVS and buy a box of hair color and think, this isn't that hard. And then it turns orange or it turns completely black or it turns a shade of eggplant. And then they don't even realize it. And they're the mockery of the world. We saw this happen with a partner at Goldman Sachs. I heard the story about someone who, very senior person, very successful, decided to dye his hair. It turned orange. It looked very 45th presidential. And he was the subject of great mirth and ridicule, but all kind of behind his back. There was even a skit that was done about him, and he had no idea. Finally, he was friends with a very well-known hairstylist who just did an intervention, cut off the orange, and now he's gray and looks fantastic.
Now, Linda, we don't see a lot of women turning orange or their hair all of a sudden transitioning straight to black. What is it about these hair dyes that you buy in the box at CVS that makes them especially prone to user error?
Well, it's very hard to find your color. They're made to be foolproof because you're doing them at home and they don't want people to, you know, bleach their hair, or their hair to fall out, or all the things that can happen if you misuse hair dye. So as a result, they kind of tend to go red. And so what happens is you apply them, they might look okay the first week. And then as you're exposed to the sun, they oxidize, they turn red, and it's a bad look. And I think that people just become acclimated to their look and don't really study it. Maybe men are particular in that way. So they really go wrong, really wrong. And they don't do variations. There's no nuance to boxed hair color. It's kind of one shade. So real hair color has a lot of different shades in it. That's why they have to go to a salon, even though they might not like sitting at the salon and having foils in their hair and they feel like it's embarrassing. Get over it. It's going to be much
better.
Belinda,
still, as you report, sales of these at-home hair color kits have grown exponentially from 2019. Do we take this to be some sort of rejection of the Silver Fox look, or is there something else going on?
Men are trying to take these matters into their own hands, and there's a positive side of this. The fact that, you know, they aren't just accepting the way things are given. They're not like, women have done this forever and thought, you know, let me try something. Let me work on a different part of myself. And maybe that's not always the most evolved thing to do, but there's no shame in wanting to look better. In my opinion, of course, I would say that as this is my beat. But so I feel like the territory is that the men's hair color is in the boxed world is really growing more than anything else. And that's because men are still a little embarrassed about going to a salon, but they still want to make a change. So I think that the big message here is that if you go to a salon, you're going to get a lot better result. And most of these men can afford it. I mean, some of the people who are doing it, look at Elon Musk. That hair is not normal. That's a very pitch black head of hair. Donald Trump. I mean, maybe he's not quite the billionaire he used to be, but he doesn't really need to be using box color. And you can go on down the list. Brian Johnson, the man who spends $2 million a year, presumably on looking younger and longevity hacks, has hair that looks like it came right from Just for Men. So they need to invest a little bit more.
Excuse me, ladies. Yes, I've got gray, as you say, Silver Fox, but agree with you entirely, Linda. And I think for me, the problem is it's less of the orange and that Elon Musk. It's this Tony Stark thing where I'm not going to name names of people I know. The telltale giveaway is it's dead to light. Normal hair, it has shades, it has colors like in light. And these people with it's like, it just is like they took something and they spray painted their head. And that's always the giveaway. And I think it's probably my theory is, I think you're saying this as well, that guy's like, well, I can do this myself. I can fix my car by myself. We don't need to call a handyman. I can do this. And guys with lots of money. But like, it's like, I can change my all about myself. Whoops. But they've got no one to then say to them, listen, spend a little more money. As you note in your story as well, like it's a little bit of that version of does she or doesn't she? Now it's like, does he or doesn't he? You look at guys, I'm not saying, but like a Brad Pitt, who probably is adding very subtle shades of blonde and honey, as Brooke might say, to his hair, right? It's stitched in there, right?
Right. Well, yes, with Brad Pitt, the emphasis is on honey. But I mean, I think that some of these actors, they spend their time preparing for roles and they don't have the same kind of personal ego involved in it. They're always getting their hair done. They're always getting makeup. So to them, going to a professional to get their hair colored is nothing. So they've already broken down that barrier. But yes, it's the weaving of the gray and the color together and not trying to be turn back the clock until you were like 18, which is just not believable. And it looks really bad. The contrast of an aged face, and I'm all for aged faces, and just ridiculous stark black hair or whatever color it happens to be is really unflattering. So it's like the colorist I spoke to said you mix in these rinses with the regular color and it actually blends everything together and gives much more dimension. And you just have to get it done by a professional. It's not a big deal and they can afford it. But I think you're right. It's like this idea that I can do it myself. This isn't that hard. I can do it. And then they walk around looking crazy. You don't want them to be looking crazy. They should have all the advantages that women have. Not to be all gendered.
Linda, for our next story for Airmail Look, we should do a diary or a directory of the best colorists for men. I'm sure there are lots of them out there who specialize in this. They are here to help.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting because I was surprised at how hard it was to find people to talk to about hair color for men, because I think men don't go that often. And when they go, they have to keep it a secret. So I spoke with a lot of people in LA. I was out in LA last week for the story and they could not, of course, you couldn't mention any of their clients. But I know.
Look, would I want to be sitting there with foil in my hair for an hour and a half? But as you also know, there's people in your story who do it now.
Yeah, I talked to a friend who does it, and he was not ashamed at all.
Right, what's more embarrassing, that or standing in front of a meeting and people like, what's with the spray paint head?
Right. And people laughing at you. Nobody wants that. So I say, fix yourself up, men.
But if you were on a date with someone, like, is it a deal breaker? The guy shows up, you're like, oh my God, is it a deal breaker?
Absolutely. Because it's a sign that either they're clueless or they have absolutely no confidence, or, I mean, I just think it's a lack of self-knowledge. That to me is a deal breaker. Yes.
Is it ever too young to do this or ever too old to do it?
No, you could do it. I mean, I think it's just a matter of doing the right amount. As I say, I'm not against doing something. I just think it's delusional to think that you're fooling anybody when you have your hair color like with shoe polish. That's delusional.
Michael, have you ever been tempted to dye your fabulous hair? Because your hair is one of your signature features. For those of you who don't know Michael, he's got an incredible cut. I'd like to know who cuts it and why you haven't colored it.
My man Gino cuts it and he's great. I can't even imagine coloring it. I'm grateful I've got hair. You start with that. I think to me, it's always like, I think salt and pepper, silver fox, whatever you want to call it, I think it looks great.
It does look great, Michael. And also, people who are coloring their hair are coloring it to look like your hair. So you are the platonic ideal of hair color and you hang right onto it.
Okay, so Michael, whereas Rudy Giuliani has a cautionary tale, you are an inspiration, our friend.
Yes, no black shoe polish running down the side of my head at my press conferences.
Yes. Yeah.
One can always hope, Linda.
Right? And if that happens, you come right to me and Ashley and we'll help you.
Look, everyone's got to do what they want to do, but I just, no, thank you.
It's not your bag, baby.
No, baby.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for this great column and your great insights into Airmail Look. You can read the new issue at airmail.news/look and you can get Linda's column in this week's issue of Airmail. Thank you.
Thank you all. Lovely day.
Thank you, Linda.
All right, Michael, is it okay if we call you the patron saint of silver foxes everywhere here? I think we should declare that to be your new nickname. It could be your handle on X.
Okay. Well, moving right along. The other place you always see hair dye is in crime movies where the guy's like painting his mustache and his hair black to try and escape. And it reminds me that surely Scott Thorson, the subject of this crazy story that Spike Carter has for us in this week's issue, is a man who may or may not have dabbled in hair dye at some point. Because he seems to have dabbled in just about everything else seedy. Thorson wrote the book that became the film, Behind the Candelabra. He also was linked to the infamous Wonderland murders in Los Angeles that were later fictionalized in the movie Boogie Nights. And Spike has spent a lot of time with a man he calls the Zelig of Awful to learn his story.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's bring him on. Spike Carter is a writer at large for Airmail, based here in London, and also a producer of documentaries. Welcome, Spike.
I guess.
Spike, this story really has everything. We need you to take us back to the very beginning. Where did you first hear whispers about these bizarre characters?
Well, the story came to me through our good friend, Sam Kashner. Predictably, he was approached by Scott to work on a book about his role as the star witness to the Wonderland murders. The timing wasn't great for him. So last year I started interviewing Scott and my jaw hit the floor when he started telling some of these stories, because I was familiar with his life with Liberace from Behind the Candelabra, but I just could not believe how he was just I fully understood why he's been called the Zelig of Awful. He shows up in every single dubious circumstance you could possibly imagine.
So you mentioned Behind the Candelabra. So Scott Thorson wrote the book that became the movie that starred Matt Damon. So take us a little bit through how he goes from Wisconsin to hanging out with mobsters and running cocaine.
So he was like in and out of foster homes and orphanages for most of his young life and was a runaway when he first met Liberace in 1977. So Scott had just turned 18. Liberace was 57. So it's a roughly 40-year age gap. Liberace really sniffed out the parental neglect that Scott clearly held. Scott wanted a father. Liberace wanted a son, but just a son with bedroom benefits, if you will. It's worth remembering that he was the highest paid entertainer in the world at the time. I mean, late 70s, early 80s bucks, $23 million annually for his Vegas residency is really something else. And Scott wasn't just his domestic boy toy. He also hired him to be his onstage chauffeur. So for those who are unfamiliar, Scott would drive this dazzling, bejeweled Rolls Royce from offstage to then present Liberace to his audience. So he'd come out of the Rolls Royce wearing the most ostentatious jewelry and furs you could possibly imagine. And then he'd take his seat at this insane crystal-laden piano, which had trademark candelabra on top. And like from there, he just tickled the ivories with lightning speed. And his audience was rapturous, mostly sort of middle-aged housewives who had the most out-of-tune gaydars in history. I mean, it was incredible. That hard to believe now, but most of his audience didn't realize that he was gay. So this was like Scott's first gig, was introducing the titanic talent on stage. And if all that sort of sounds weird, it got a lot weirder when plastic surgery entered the equation. Liberace wanted to fashion young Scott into essentially the son that he never had. So he had a plastic surgeon give him a nose job, restructured his cheekbones, and even gave him a chin implant with a fake cleft to match Liberace's. And so Scott went under the knife and came out with a new face. Liberace also wanted Scott to lose some of the extra pounds that he had gained since beginning to live the good life. So the surgeon prescribed Scott what was then referred to as the Hollywood diet. And like now that might mean just cue jumping diabetics for Ozempic. But back then it was pharmaceutical cocaine, speed, and Quaaludes, which is probably the most Moorish cocktail of drugs there is. So he obviously becomes hooked. And when he is strung out and becomes sort of desperate, Liberace dumps him. Scott sues Liberace for, it was America's first ever same-sex palimony, sues him for $113 million and totally protracted. He finally settles for $75K and a few cars and dogs worth another $20K in 1986. And so that's sort of what happened behind the candelabra, but the piece goes beyond the candelabra to Scott's role in the Wonderland Murders.
And take us up to the Wonderland Murders, because then that's the scene that's sort of like a set piece inside Boogie Nights with the firecrackers and all that stuff. And it's actually a true crime that involves a lot of drugs, which thanks to the Hollywood diet, Scott is now hungry for more diet aids and ends up with some bizarre characters there, right?
Yes. So like rewinding to 1980, when Scott and Liberace were still together, Scott is introduced to Eddie Nash, who was a Palestinian immigrant who arrived to America with $7 in his pocket, opened a successful hot dog stand, and amazingly, by the 80s, was the number one club owner in Los Angeles at the time. So a real American success story. What Liberace didn't know in suggesting that Scott go into business with Nash was that Nash is also the biggest drug lord in Los Angeles. Scott, who's now hooked on the Hollywood diet, goes into business with Nash. Scott brings some of his sort of high profile celebrity contacts from life with Liberace to their Rolodex. So they're now dealing together to John Belushi and Richard Pryor and members of Fleetwood Mac and Rod Stewart. Scott sort of, he pitches Nash as kind of like almost like the Oppenheimer of drugs, because he insists that Nash was the first dealer to freebase cocaine, which then gave way to crack. So when they started selling crack, there was one customer who was just far and away the most crack obsessed, and that was John Holmes, the Elvis Presley of pornography, who claims he slept with 14,000 women. By like summer of 1981, he had a $1,500 a day crack habit, so his brain was hardly functioning anyway. But Nash really liked having him around because you'd always have a harem of women, and you'd refer to Holmes as my brother. And Holmes, though, was really just such a weasel, and he had just burned every bridge around him. So he had begun spending more time at this Laurel Canyon townhouse, which he would sort of go to when his credit line with Nash was overextended. The inhabitants of this townhouse were just a very scuzzy group of addicts and criminals. And one summer evening in 1981, he's totally desperate with, they're called the Wonderland Gang, the inhabitants of this townhouse. They're all scheming. They got no drugs, no money. The gang had just sold a pound of baking soda as cocaine for $250K. And so there were contracts out on their lives. But Holmes tells them, I've got the perfect heist. Let's rip off Eddie Nash. He loves me. He totally trusts me. So he like showing them a plan of like where all of Nash's valuables are stored so that they can go rip him off. Holmes beforehand said he will go to the house for a drug purchase, leave the sliding door unlocked, head out, let them know when the coast is clear and the Wonderland Gang can come in and they know where all the drugs are, where all the money is. So the next morning they break in and it's brutally violent. They make off with $1 million in cash, like miscellany of other valuables, and just an absolute mountain of drugs. So that's sort of kind of the Wonderland story that most would know. But at the same time, Scott was about to fly from Vegas to the Sierra Tahoe resort with Liberace to do his chauffeur shtick. And he realized that he was out of coke. So he wanted to go to pick up a pound for personal consumption. He charters a jet, like a last minute jet from Vegas to LA, goes to Nash's, totally unaware of the robbery. He arrives at the house and it's just an absolute shit show. Nash is ranting and raving, waving a gun around. He's vowing bloody revenge. Thorsten hangs around with him to get high. And while this lighting up a crack rock after crack rock, Greg Dials, who's Eddie Nash's like 400-pound security guard, he barges in holding John Holmes by like the scruff of his neck. He had spotted John Holmes on the street wearing one of the rings that he had stolen from Eddie Nash. So Scott is excused to the bedroom while Greg Dials and Eddie Nash beat a confession out of Holmes. He spills the beans about the Wonderland gang. And Nash then orders Holmes and his Dials and his associates to go back, go to Wonderland and exact revenge, kill them all and return his property. So Scott is just completely terrified. He's there when Holmes and Nash's associates come back and sees him just covered in blood. They recount the revenge in just absolutely disgusting detail. And he's told to basically keep his mouth shut, which he does for many years, except he did tell Liberace, who pretty soon after realized how dangerous the situation that Scott has gotten himself into is. So he dumps the vixen, fires him in short order. And Scott then, with nowhere else to go, ends up going into business full time with Nash and keep his silence for years until Nash throws him under the bus for a crime that Scott says he didn't commit. So Scott then, looking to make a deal with the feds, says he'll be there. He details what he witnessed at Nash's charge. Thorsten gives a detailed testimony. The trial ends in an 11-1 hung jury, though. And Scott knew that Nash had paid off that one dissenting juror. And he has to go into witness protection. And I'm almost hesitant to even detail what goes on in witness protection.
That alone is extraordinary. So I want to encourage everyone to read the story in this week's issue because it leaves one reeling, much like probably all the drugs that Scott ingested. I'm going to jump forward then. Scott then goes into witness protection, does some time in prison, does some time with evangelicals. So where is Scott now and how old is he? And tell us about who he is now.
So Scott is 65 now. He got out of prison for, again, after a like nearly 7-year stint in 2020. And he finally got clean during that final stint in jail. And it's very accurate to say that he's had 9 lives. I mean, not just because of the insanity of what he's survived, as one will see if they read the piece, but also just how no one has lived a life quite as jam-packed as his. So he's just sort of a fascinating and oddly like life-affirming person to be around because he knows that he's living on borrowed time, essentially. So he really wants to get this story of this part of his life out there. So we're working on a book together about all this now. I guess for those who aren't as familiar with what Wonderland murders meant at the time, like if the Manson family's Hate LaBianca murders were sort of the horrifying hangover of the hippie utopian 60s, Wonderland was like the really grisly coda to the nihilism of the 70s. It's really like the other most notorious mass murder in the city's history.
Well, Spike, it's a fantastic story, amazing profile on your part, and can't wait to read the book. So I encourage everyone to read it in this week's issue of Airmail. And Spike, thanks so much for being with us today, man.
Hey, thank you, guys.
Okay, Michael, as you recall, I went to the Burberry show in London back in February, and I have a thing for the brand's new chief creative officer, Daniel Lee. I wanted everything, especially the bags.
Which one did you have your eye on?
Well, I love what Lee's done with the house's logo. He's a real innovator, and he used the lowercase b as a high-tech but easy-to-fasten clasp on some of the bags. It's especially great in the rocking horse style, which is my current favorite.
Well, there is a certain holiday coming up. Is this the kind of gift that would guarantee your happiness on Mother's Day, perhaps?
Absolutely. It's inspired by Burberry's equestrian heritage, and its playful name is reflected in its shape, which resembles the rocking horses that my children used to love. When it's placed on its base, it rocks back and forth.
You know, this has given me some ideas for my mother as well. There are many other great options too, like her favorite scarves, wallets, and card cases that feature the house's signature Burberry check.
There are great gifts for all different types of stylish mothers and maternal figures at Burberry.com. Michael, this is just yet another reason why I'm never, ever again going to Las Vegas. I'm sorry.
Yeah, or, you know, getting involved with people like Liberace.
That was never a real concern in the first place, but yes. What can you say? Like, you gotta love a man who drives that kind of a Cadillac and wears spangled clothes and plays a huge piano.
Yeah, well, that's men of one sort. And then there's men that Lee Carpenter is talking about this week, thanks to Michael Korda, the author. And it's writers who basically changed the course of English literature early in the 20th century and created the voice for writers for much of that century.
Lee Carpenter is a novelist. She's the author of 11 Days, Red, White, and Blue, and most recently Ilium, which we loved. And she's also a professor at Columbia University, and she's ducking out of class to talk to us about this book. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have delved into a fascinating world for the issue of Airmail this week, taking us back to World War I and some of the soldier poets whose work is still relevant today. So tell us a bit about this fascinating new book from Michael Korda.
Sure. So I had the great luck of meeting Michael Korda pretty recently, and he knows that I have an interest in war literature. And he told me he had just finished and was about to publish this book called Muse of Fire, which takes its title from Henry V. He really felt that it was so timely to look back now at these young men who had gone into World War I and look at how they changed and their poetry had changed over the course of the war. So you really see this tragic arc that you've seen in other wars up to and including our most recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the young men who entered at the beginning entered with incredible hope and optimism, and that's reflected in their work, a sense of sort of bring on death. This is going to be a great adventure. And there's an incredible excitement and lyrical optimism in those early works. And then as you get deeper into the war, you get past the Battle of the Somme, you start to see the human costs that occur during this war. As with any other war, you get a shift in the tone to more cynical work, more politicized work, more critical work. And you have to remember that these guys, as is always the case with the, really, I think of them now as almost children on the front lines, they were so young. So they were in their late teens or early 20s, and they were going to fight for their country and in a war that at the time people thought would be the war to end all wars.
Some of these poets are well known. I just wonder if you could share with our audience who they are. And also, as you, I think, note, like, they didn't just change poetry, they changed English literature in a way, because we're still 100 years later reacting to the voice they kind of brought into not just poetry, but literature as well.
They did. I think you could say that they ushered in what we now call modern English literature. I think you can plausibly say that they laid the groundwork for something like The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, which broke all sorts of literary rules at the time. English literature, up until this point, had more of a discipline to it. I'm not an English literature scholar by any means, and I think it's not unrelated to the chaos and the fracturing of the experience of being in a war.
As you note, I mean, in your story, it's Rupert Brooke, Alan Seeger, Isaac Rosenberg, Robert Graves, Sigrid Sassoon, and Wilfred Owen, probably best known of them. As you note, they also sort of like had gone into this, it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country mindset, but then I think laid this sort of stage, you said, for the beginning of modernism with T.S. Eliot and all this sort of like clear-eyed view of what hell the 20th century was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, Eliot and Pound, if you really just look at Brooke at the start of the war and Owen towards the end of the war, and Brooke, by the way, barely saw any combat, but is thought of as kind of the poster child of this group, not only because he was sort of like the Jude Law of his day. He was beloved by the literati, beloved by Winston Churchill. He ran in very kind of high-flying social circles, and he was a great poster boy for the grandeur of England at the time. And he went in with optimism. And of course, then you end up with Wilfred Owen, who saw the war through a much darker lens. And I think that there are analogs to this set of poets, as I've said, in later wars. But what really distinguishes this group, I think, is that they were able to write freely. Their poems were never censored. And if you look just at this, you know, 4 or 5 year span's worth of work, you can see the journey of a kind of national response to this conflict. There's a whole part in the book where he gets into what we would now call PTSD, which was once, I think, originally known as soldier's heart, which is a very poetic, speaking of poetry, way to describe a condition that can be incredibly debilitating. But it is this experience of coming back from a war and having to cope with the kind of meaninglessness of it all. And I think Michael Korda really gets into that beautifully.
Leah, it also struck me that we saw so much incredible poetry out of World War I. I was trying to think of other conflicts that had sort of a school of writers in this vein, specifically with regards to poetry. Are there any, or is this really a World War I phenomenon?
Poetry, to state the blindingly obvious, there was no social media, there was no Snapchat, there was no real film business, all of the art forms that now dominate our ways of communicating really didn't exist then. Poetry was still central. It seems odd today to think that you could find five poets in a similar situation. So I think it is less the lack of poets and more the shifting place that poetry occupies sort of in the broader literary landscape. Well, now when you think about these poets, they were writing poetry in real time while they were going through it. And I guess you could say that a poet is a pretty low cost venture to sit down and write a poem, but these guys were doing it literally in the trenches. And I think that also informs a sense of immediacy in the work that you don't tend to see as much in other art forms.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for sharing not only this incredible book with us, but also your very informed point of view.
I can't recommend this book highly enough and any other books by Michael Cordes. And thank you for letting me come on.
Great to see you, Lee. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, after you've watched the Steven Soderbergh film about Liberace starring Matt Damon, then you can read this great book and you can get a fuller picture of the spectrum of male experiences.
You know where you can find some great books right now, Ashley?
The West Village?
The West Village at what? The new Airmail newsstand.
Hey, this is a very exciting moment for all of us here at Airmail, right on Hudson Street, very close to Dante for those of us who love cocktails. We have a fantastic new newsstand, and Anjali Lewis, who is our shop general manager and heads up our brand partnerships at Airmail, is here to tell us all about the hottest development in New York retail in centuries. Welcome, Anjali.
Hello, so glad to be here.
So this is obviously the hugest news ever when it comes to the West Village, but we have a quasi-long and storied history in retail, it turns out, here at Airmail. So Anj, tell us a little bit about, first of all, our newsstand in London and also our operation in Milan.
Our London newsstand was our first, and it's quite exciting because we opened it during the pandemic. So none of us in New York saw it until probably late 2020, if not 2021. But the idea of opening a newsstand was very far from our minds, especially during the time that we were thinking about it. But very honestly, the biggest idea of protecting print and really saving businesses that we felt incredibly strongly about, which is magazine kiosks and magazine shops. And when we were approached by Gabriel Tupperfield and his partner, Sandy Garg, about the little shop that they were renovating on Chiltern Street, we jumped in wholeheartedly. And that was our first foray. And it turned into such a great part of that street and of that community. And then our next project was in Milan, where Isabel Harvey Wad, one of our editors, connected with Fabrizio Pastinare, who is a storied newsstand operator. And all of a sudden, this business was born. And it's been such a wonderful moment to introduce readers and customers and friends to Airmail in such a unique way.
So Anj, tell us about how we landed on Hudson Street in New York and what visitors can expect when they join us at the Airmail newsstand.
Sure. So the Airmail newsstand in New York has been a long time coming. The first thing you see is beautifully built cabinets of magazines that are incredibly curated. We are not for everyone, but we would love to be everything for someone. And then as you go inside, there are products that we sell on Air Supply, which is our e-commerce platform, as well as exclusives to Hudson. So everything from Master Boddington stationery to vintage watches from Foundwell to leather-bound classic books. And there's a book section in the back. There's homewares and pencils and stationery and all sorts of wonderful treats that you can either pick up very easily or make an investment in. And we call it a newsstand because we care deeply about that medium, but we also want it to be a little bit of a Alice through the Looking Glass. So you just aren't quite sure what you're going to get when you get there. And then we also have a cafe with Shell's amazing coffee and pastries.
I can vouch for the hot chocolate. It's excellent. We also have a pretty amazing Airmail merchandise, which those of us that walk around town like Larry David wearing our Airmail cap know the power of the Airmail hat. But we also have the bags, Anj. We've got some amazing keychains. I'm sorry to sound so self-promotional here, but what's sort of the other collectible Airmail merch that you can find only on Hudson Street?
Sure. Right now, our merch are the top sellers at the shop amongst all the other things that we have there. But as we're opening Hudson Street, we spent time developing new product for Hudson Street specifically. quickly, and some of them will be available online. So we're sort of deciding what goes online and what stays at this particular shop. But we've launched Umbrella, which we've wanted for a very long time. And those of us that were in New York a couple of weeks ago really craved one. We have developed an amazing enamel tray. So think of those trays that you see all over Europe, or actually back in the day, that were used as advertising.
Anjali, one of the things you mentioned I really liked when I ran into you there yesterday checking out the shop is it's my perfect fantasy, because what do you love about a newsstand? Oh, it's got things to read and buy. And what do you really want to do when you're in a newsstand? You want to sit down and have a cup of coffee. So it's two worlds, my two dreams push into one place, much like the places you mentioned in London. So I'm excited about it. And I think when I've spent time there yesterday, what you see already is, I think all of us in New York, what do you long for? You long for community spaces, places where you can come together and meet people and interact and hang out a little bit, have a conversation. And there's so few of those, really, when you think about it, in the city. I mean, aside from crappy coffee shops, so this is, you feel like you're somewhere between, you've combined the best of the West Village with a little bit of Paris and a bit of London all in one. And even that space we've gotten back where you can hang out with your coffee a little longer. I think it's a great addition to the community and a great place to hang out and have a great cup of coffee and read something. So that's what I've been loving about that you guys have put together there.
Well, we've done it then, because that's exactly what we hoped people would feel when they walk into the shop and make it their own.
And Anj, as the months roll on, we're going to have some programming there, right? Like, you guys are working on doing maybe some book events or some talks, or can you tell us about how people can stay on top of all things Airmail Newsstand on Hudson Street? Is there a website we should go to, or an Instagram account, or?
Sure. So we'll be promoting or posting on our Airmail Weekly Instagram account things that are happening that are available to the public. Our sales staff is amazing, and they'll be able to send invitations and notices to customers. So if you haven't stopped in, stop in and definitely share your email address if you want to get more information. Or you can go to Air Supply. You can find our shop on airmail.news and sign up for our newsletters. And I do have a secret hope that perhaps one day you guys will be recording your podcast from the shop.
We would love nothing more, especially if it comes with unlimited quantities of flying coffee. Anj, thank you so much. Congratulations to you and the whole team. You guys have worked tirelessly on this for months and months, and it's such a beauty.
Thank you so much. Please come visit us. The team is really excited to welcome anyone who walks in the door.
Fab. Thanks again. See you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anjali. Take care.
Bye.
It's the weekend. I'm sure you've got something you can recommend to us.
I was just thinking, listening to Lee Carpenter talking about this book about World War I, I just want to put a reminder to people. I mentioned this a few episodes ago, but if you haven't watched Masters of the Air on Apple TV, which is the true story of the Bloody 100th Bomber Group of U.S. pilots and U.S. bombers stationed in England during the war, paid a heavy price for helping to liberate Europe. I would highly recommend it. It stars Austin Butler and a number of other people, and it's based on the memoir of one of the guys in it, and it's just extraordinary lives, one of which was a bomber pilot who flew 52 missions and survive. So anyway, I highly recommend it. It's called Master of the Air on Apple TV. And you, my dear?
Have you seen this new movie on Netflix called Scoop?
I have not. Tell me all about it.
It's fantastic. It's based on a memoir called Scoopsa, plural, which was written by Sam McAllister. She was the BBC Newsnight producer who secured the interview with Prince Andrew that eventually became the program Prince Andrew and the Epstein scandal, which eventually led to Prince Andrew stepping down from his duties with regards to the royal family in 2019. So obviously you remember seeing the BBC interview, but this is really the story behind the story about how it all came together. And it's the kind of movie we love because it's, frankly, it's a glamorizing journalism and making our job seem really exciting and fabulous, which they are, but it's really well done. Billy Piper plays Sam McAllister, who's this tough, gritty producer at the very rarefied BBC, trying to make her mark and earn the respect of her colleagues. And she definitely does that when she lands this interview with Prince Andrew. And the acting is fantastic. Gillian Anderson plays Emily Maitlis. She's wonderful in that role as well. So I highly enjoyed it. It's called Scoop. It's on Netflix right now. Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We'd like to extend a special thanks to our sponsor, Burberry, which is responsible for so many of our favorite things. Michael, will you please read us out?
Oh, well, I'm just going to go touch up my hair first. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alison Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. And the theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.